Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, this is News Desk. It's Tuesday, February the 5th. I'm John Dennis. Today, in the biggest review ever conducted, scientists find no link between autism and the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine. Climate change experts name the areas of the world most immediately at risk from global warming. And as the new housing minister, Caroline Flint, tells The Guardian she wants to make council tenants look for work, Polly Toynbee tells us what she thinks.
Caroline Flint is one of those politicians who's rather sharper of tongue than she is of brain. This is a daft idea.
There is no evidence to link the measles, mumps and rubella vaccination to autism in children. That's according to a substantial new study published today. Scientists from Guy's Hospital in London, Manchester University and the Health Protection Agency analysed the blood from 250 children. They concluded that the vaccine could not be responsible. The Department of Health funded the study. Professor David Salisbury is the department's director of immunisation, and he says it is authoritative.
It adds to what we already have got available to us. We've had quite a few studies done on epidemiological grounds, that's looking at whole populations of children, and they've been done in different countries, different techniques, different sizes, different populations. But the one thing in common is they've all come to the same conclusion, and that conclusion was they couldn't identify having MMR as a risk factor for autism. What we've got now is a different sort of study, and this is a virological study where individual children have been assessed, they've been examined, they've had histories taken from their parents, and then they've had blood tests done for two things. Firstly, to see if the profile of measles antibodies are any different to non-autistic children, which you might expect if you had a persistent measles infection. And then secondly, they've had their blood, white blood cells tested to see if they can find any of the genetic material for measles viruses that would imply that the autistic children had prolonged effects from measles virus. And the answer is that the autistic children were absolutely no different to the controls.
This research specifically investigates the theory put forward by Dr. Andrew Wakefield and his colleagues at London's Royal Free Hospital back in 1998.
Well, pretty much, yes. If you've got a persistent infection, for example, in your bowel with measles, then the virus has to get from the bowel somewhere else, and if it's going to affect the brain, it has to be carried through the blood. So testing the blood is a sensible and rational thing to do. So although you're not testing the bowel tissue, which would be very difficult, if you had a persistent infection, then blood goes through the bowel all the time, and that is the most appropriate way to do it. And it also deals with previous studies that did suggest that they had found measles virus in the blood of autistic children. So it's the right study.
And will today's study now end the controversy?
Well, you know, I'm sure there will be some people who will hold on to their beliefs and there is no evidence that would persuade them. I think that there are clearly some people for whom there is no study that will ever answer their doubts. And they will persist and they will take increasingly less rational positions. But I do hope that for many parents who have had doubts, this is pretty much the last study of this sort. It's very difficult to see how more studies can be done. Every study that has been done by reputable researchers working in high-quality laboratories or high-quality research comes to the same conclusion. Study after study, different studies, different people, different places, different everything. Same conclusion. We cannot find a link between MMR and autism. And I think it's time to say it would not be ethically appropriate to be doing more tests on children for something that clearly is not right.
Professor Salisbury, many thanks for talking to us.
Guardian Daily. with John Dennis.
The Guardian's daily news podcast is changing. For a start, it won't be called News Desk anymore. From next Monday, February the 11th, we launch Guardian Daily, which will be available to download from first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday. So you can listen to it while you're having your breakfast or take it with you on your way to work. The best news and analysis from The Guardian's top team of reporters and commentators. Guardian Daily. Guardian.co.uk/podcasts.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Scientists know that climate change could melt our ice sheets and wither our rainforests and cause flash floods and droughts. Well, now the areas of the planet that are most at risk have been ranked in order of their vulnerability. You might think that we won't see the catastrophic effects of global warming for many years, but Ian Sample, our science correspondent, says some of these areas could collapse before the end of the century.
I mean, what these guys have done is they've looked at, if you look around the globe, you can find particularly fragile and vulnerable ecosystems. And these might be Arctic sea ice. They might be some of the huge ice sheets like Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheets, but also some of a lot of the forests, the Amazon, and also places like Africa, the Sahara, and so on. And the issue with these places in particular is that a small rise in temperature from global warming can suddenly cause the damage not to just get gradually worse, but suddenly go catastrophically bad. And it doesn't mean that you will suddenly lose ice sheets overnight, but you take them past the point of no return so that they are then committed to really massive destruction. In the case of Greenland, over probably many hundreds of years, but it will go and you won't get it back. And this is what this study is all about. It's finding those most vulnerable places and then ranking them to see which are the most sensitive, which are the ones which are really close to going or that we may even be committed to already.
And presumably to know when these different tipping points might be reached will help us prioritise.
This is the idea, and what these scientists are really calling for is an early warning system that you could put out around these. They've chosen nine as their real sort of short list of places where we could see big trouble before the end of the century. And if you can predict those more accurately, then you can certainly start to think about what on earth you do about them. I mean, it may well be too late to do much in terms of trying to bring back emissions more, because that is such a slow-moving process, as we've seen since Kyoto. But in a lot of the instances, if we are going to see sea level rises go up enormously, we will start having to think very, very quickly and certainly very seriously about ways of dealing with that.
Could you sort of talk us through a kind of nightmare scenario, I suppose, of what might happen before the end of this century?
The Greenland ice sheet. Absolutely phenomenal amount of ice there. If that goes, you're committed to a 7-metre sea rise around the world. Some scientists think that we have probably gone past the point of no return with Greenland already, or that there is at least that much warming in the system already. Some think it may well go in the next sort of decade or so, and that just means you flip the tipping point. It still stays there, but melts gradually. So Greenland alone, you're looking at 7 metres. If the West Antarctic ice sheet goes at the other pole, a further 5 metres of sea rise. But these are things we're quite familiar with. There are also other things like El Nino, which causes it's a climatic system which causes extreme weather from Africa to North America. It certainly gave the world the warmest year on record last year. That is predicted to become more intense by the end of the century. So this just means it will go past the tipping point where it will suddenly become very chaotic. Those sorts of effects will hit on around the world. The same with the forests, the same with Africa. What on earth will happen in Africa in terms of the deserts? Will some of it regreen? Will some of it get a lot worse? There's a lot of uncertainty, but the actual tipping points for when those systems become very chaotic seem to be very close.
That's Ian Sample, and there's more on that at guardian.co.uk/environment. Also on Guardian Unlimited today, in the light of the alleged bugging of the MP Sadiq Khan, Roy Hattersley argues that surveillance must not be at the casual disposal of the police and security services. Have your say on that at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. England's cricketers have beaten New Zealand in the 2020 match in Auckland. A quickfire 43 from Kevin Peterson helped England to an unassailable total of 184. Ryan Sidebottom was the pick of England's bowlers, and there's an interview with him at guardian.co.uk/cricket. And The Guardian's got an exclusive story on its front page today, which you can read online at guardian.co.uk/politics. The new housing minister, Caroline Flint, tells The Guardian today that she wants to tell social housing tenants that if they want a council house, they're going to have to go and find a job. More than half of people living in social housing are out of work. The government says it wants to lift people in deprived areas out of poverty. But The Guardian's columnist Polly Toynbee tells us that Caroline Flint has got it wrong.
Caroline Flint is one of those politicians who's rather sharper of tongue than she is of brain. This is a daft idea. It's also phony politics, and she must know it perfectly well. And if she doesn't, she ought to. The idea that there are a whole lot of people in social housing, you could easily move into work. Well, she's just come from the Department of Work and Pensions, job centres. They're the ones responsible for it. They're the ones who should be pushing people into work. And indeed, they are, and they do. Most of the people in social housing now are old or with very young children or sick or disabled or have serious problems. Nobody gets given a council house now unless they've got usually several children. I don't see how you're going to force those single mothers to work when there's usually some quite good reason why they're not. Most single mothers want to work. So it's just a kind of saber-rattling, stirring up the worst kind of prejudices against people who are pretty vulnerable. And if there are people who aren't working, should be, then it's her fault from her time at the Department of Work and Pensions.
Nevertheless, there are pockets of joblessness in council house areas. What's the best way to deal with these areas?
There are indeed pockets of tremendous joblessness, particularly in London, for instance, a lot of the London council estates. But there are very good reasons why, because London has one of the most highest unemployment and yet loads of jobs available. So people keep saying, why on earth aren't these people working? And then every time they go and look, it turns out it's for good practical reasons, which the government could solve, if only they could make childcare in London affordable. If only they could make systems where people didn't lose too much housing benefit if they went out to work. These are basic, easy things. Most mothers do want to work once their children are in school. And in London, there are really big obstacles to that, and the government should simply pay their childcare, then they'd work. In other areas, well, there are a lot of places like sort of Easington or places that are old industrial areas, very, very depressed, where there really isn't much work. And in most areas these days, the people who are left in council houses or in social housing are not the same as they were 30 years ago. The people left behind are the most helpless, and in some ways perhaps the most hopeless, you could say the most feckless, but they're also the most unemployable. Employers take one look at them and think, no, I'd rather have the right young Pole, thanks. And that's not necessarily the fault of those people.
That's Polly Toynbee. I'm John Dennis and this is News Desk. Still to come. Today, the United States takes a huge step towards deciding on its next president. Our US correspondents explain how Super Tuesday works. And it's not just Super Tuesday today. It's also Shrove Tuesday.
I'm cooking this in a little oil today. In fact, you need very little oil in the pan. And it's just flour, milk and eggs. Very healthy.
But first, Haroon Sadiq's here with a look at today's papers. And Haroon, Prince Andrew has criticised the George Bush administration over Iraq.
He's given an interview to the International Herald Tribune in which he says that the US should have listened and learned over the post-war strategy. And he said that because they didn't, there's now a healthy scepticism regarding what's said in Washington. And this has also been picked up by The Telegraph on its front page, in which it says that his comments were unprecedented and a remarkable departure from the usual protocol, whereby royals aren't really supposed to comment on such sensitive issues.
And there's an absolutely terrifying photograph that's appeared in many of the papers today. The Guardian's got it on its double page in the middle of the paper. A baby was thrown from, was it three stories, from a burning building?
I think it was actually the fourth story of an apartment block in Germany. And the parents were desperate, and so they dropped him out of the window. And miraculously, a policeman actually caught him. But the Mirror reports that, unfortunately, others did perish. I think up to nine have been killed, five of those children, and it's not clear whether the parents of the toddler shown in the picture survived.
And a suicide bombing in Israel yesterday in a town with a nuclear facility.
Yes, I think it was relatively far from the nuclear facility. I don't think that was ever seriously under threat. But the significance of it was that it was the first suicide bombing within Israel in more than a year. And one of the suicide bombers managed to detonate his explosives and one person was killed. The other was dramatically shot as he prepared to detonate his own while he was lying injured. But it's being blamed on this breach of the Gaza-Egypt border. The Guardian says that the two bombers made their way from Gaza to Israel and via the Sinai Desert into southern Israel, which it says will be very embarrassing for the Egyptian government.
Now, Super Tuesday today, we'll hear more on that very shortly. But Hillary Clinton, before the New Hampshire primary, people might remember that she was seen shedding some tears, and it was a lot of commentators thought that that turned it round for her and won her New Hampshire. Well, she's been blubbing again, Haroon.
She certainly has been blubbing again. There's a picture of her on the front page of the Times, and the Telegraph says that what made her cry, or well up at least, was a reference by an old friend who said he was very proud to see this woman who he remembered as a young woman wearing bell bottoms running for the White House. I'm not sure whether she was just embarrassed that she used to wear flares. I think more likely the fact that Obama is at least neck and neck and even ahead in one poll. As the Independent says, the momentum is very much with Barack Obama. The question is whether he's got enough time to take advantage of that momentum.
And we might see some tears from some of our top footballers.
There's a story that makes, I think, all the sports pages, which everyone who thinks our football stars are overpaid and underworked will delight in. Capello strikes the whip is the headline on the Times, and it was Fabio Capello's first training session of the England squad. And he's apparently told them no more PlayStations and dress smart. And Rio Ferdinand said it was like going to school on a first day. Whether any of them got their heads flushed down the toilet, he doesn't say.
Well, thanks very much for that, Haroon. And don't forget, you can read a review of the papers every day by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. And you can listen to our new Football Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/podcasts.
Guardian's Football Weekly, rounding up the week in real football, the kind where receivers are what you find at Luton. Giants do get beaten and tight ends... Ashley Cole's lawyer said we can't do that one. Anyway, in this week's show, we're going to be rounding up the miracle at Craven Cottage as Fulham bounce back from the threat of relegation and as Keegan's Newcastle go from the sublime to the ridiculous without bothering about the sublime bit. We salute Mickey Owen's return to the big time. We've got words from Paul Doyle from Africa, for the Africa Cup of Nations, of course. There's all the latest from around Europe as well, and plenty of posts from the listeners. That's all in Football Weekly. For details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
It's Super Tuesday, the most important day in the long race to find the candidates for this year's presidential election. Today, half the country gets to vote for the Republican and Democratic nominations. So, to explain who gets to vote, which states we should be looking at, and when we'll get the decisive results, here's The Guardian's correspondents in Washington, Ewan McCaskill and Suzanne Goldenberg.
Super Tuesday, explain who votes today.
Today could be decisive for both the Democrats and the Republicans. We've got a bigger election than we've ever seen in a primary process before. On the Democratic side, there's 22 states that are going to hold primary elections or caucuses. There's 21 states on the Republican side. All in all, that accounts for about 40% of the delegates in each race that will determine who gets the nomination. So we've got states as big as California, which is a big prize in these states, and other superpower states like New York and New Jersey, and really quite tiny states like North Dakota that will all be going to the polls.
The candidates. Democrat candidate Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton, after almost a year in which she took clear poll leads, has found herself this week seeing the gap narrow. Suddenly is in a real contest with Barack Obama in California. Hillary has been pushing health. She thinks that's the domestic issue that can swing voters, Democratic voters. She believes it should be brought in one sort of big go, and that it should be mandatory whereas Barack Obama's sort of vaguer on the detail. He's looking for a sort of gradual introduction.
Democrat candidate Barack Obama.
Barack Obama certainly has the momentum going into the Super Tuesday contest. He's got a string of high-profile endorsements. He's campaigning side-by-side with members of the Kennedy clan. He's got Oprah Winfrey campaigning for him. So he's moving up very quickly. Whether he can move up enough to pass Hillary Clinton in the Super Tuesday contest is really uncertain. This race is a dead heat.
The Republicans.
On the Republican side, the momentum is really going John McCain's way. He's now got commanding leads across the Northeast in the big states like New York and New Jersey. In fact, he's leading the polls in every single state except for Massachusetts, which is where Mitt Romney is from and where he served a single term as governor. This battle has really come down to a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. McCain, although he's picking up a lot of support from independents, is being viewed with a bit of suspicion by traditional conservative voters. That's who Romney needs to win over if he's going to be able to hold on through Super Tuesday and into the contest beyond.
So when will we know who wins?
To some extent, the media will decide. It will be on the basis of who's got the most states, or it might be on the basis of who's got the most votes. In the Republican race, there's a good chance that it'll be decisive, that John McCain will emerge as the clear Republican nominee. But there's almost no chance of it being decisive on the Democratic side. So they'll be splitting all these states and taking delegates from all of the states and accumulating delegates. And that's what it's about. It's about the delegate count. So it's going to go on beyond this now to other big states. They'll be fighting in Washington State. They'll be fighting next week in Virginia and Maryland. And then it goes on next month to two fairly crucial states that are delegate-rich, Texas and Ohio. It's possible it could be over for the Republicans, but it's going to go on for months on the Democratic side.
And tomorrow morning, you can listen to a special edition of News Desk with the results from those elections. It's Shrove Tuesday, the last day before the Christian festival of Lent. Traditionally, people have eaten pancakes on this day because they contain fat, butter and eggs, which are forbidden during the 40-day fast before Easter. But are sales of ready-made pancake mix threatening the art of pancake making? A poll from the flour makers McDougall says only a quarter of us will be flipping our own pancakes tonight. Rebecca Smithers is our consumer affairs correspondent and she reports from the Guardian Canteen.
It's a depressing finding, but I think it reflects a sort of lack of confidence, people not knowing how to make their own batter. We're here in the Guardian's canteen, and we've got Helen Woods and Maureen Porteous, who are home economists from McDougall, the flour makers, just to show us the ingredients and the skills needed to make the sort of perfect pancake. Maureen, why aren't we making pancakes?
Well, I think it's a skill thing. I think people haven't got the confidence to make pancakes anymore, and they feel that they haven't got the skill. But actually making pancakes is so easy, which we're going to do in a minute for you.
Who are making pancakes? Is it the older generation who actually have those skills, or is it younger people who find it a bit of fun?
I think it's younger people with children. All children love pancakes, and they love flipping pancakes. So I think it's a fun element. I also think younger people, older teenagers, youngsters been to university, cheap way of eating, having people around a social event.
But are they unhealthy?
I don't think so, no. I'm cooking this in a little oil today. In fact, you need very little oil in the pan. And it's just flour, milk and eggs. Very healthy.
This poll shows that people aren't making pancakes. They don't have the confidence. They don't know how to make batter. But Marks & Spencer's, by contrast, say that the fresh ingredients to make batter are sort of walking out of their stores. And although people have the option in store to buy ready-made pancakes or the fresh ingredients, they aren't opting for the latter. So we've got some more oil going in the pan here.
You do, if the pan is too hot, when your pancake hits the pan, it'll burn on the underside. So it's a happy medium. You usually find when you're making pancakes, the first pancake's a bit of a dead loss.
Maureen, what's the art of making the perfect batter?
Into the bowl, I'm just going to sieve my plain flour and in the centre, make a well, add my egg, and then you just add half a pint of milk. Beat with a whisk until you've incorporated all the flour and you've got a nice, smooth batter. In the jug, into the pan. I've just got enough batter just to fill the bottom of the pan. You'll find once the pancake's ready to flip, it will go opaque. And as you can see, as I shake the pancake's free. Mm-hmm. And then I just tip the pancake to the edge and up and flip.
And then how long should it cook on the other side?
Just a few seconds, probably about 10, 15 seconds.
Yeah, it's really good. Thank you.
Oh, that's lovely. Very nice. Just the right texture, actually.
Jolly good. Time for me to go to the Guardian canteen right now. Today's producers were Tim Mabey, Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. And in Washington, Francesca Panetta. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.